MP.
And the next morning, the front page of the main newspaper shows a picture of François Mitterrand's wife dancing on her chair in the front row at the concert.
MP.
As 1985 dawned, things were looking dire in South Africa. The townships were burning, the economy had tanked, sanctions were hurting, there wasn't even a Rubicon to cross, and the national mood was one of despair. And into this dark hour came an event that was to bring together South Africans of all colour and musical persuasions in a spirit of togetherness. The concert in the park on January 12 sent a powerful message to us all and the world what was possible in this wounded country.
That was the day that gave young people of South Africa an idea of what the country could become.
In the music business, it's more often than not that the fame, fortune, and focus is on the artists, which, as it should be, they are the creators after all. However, a critical component of that success is the involvement of the producer, manager, and label. My guest on From the Hip this week, Hilton Rosenthal, has been all of those things. Among many achievements, he produced the bulk of the Jaluka, Savuka, and Johnny Clegg canon of recordings. He founded Music Incorporated, or MINC for short, one of South Africa's leading independent labels. He was the creator and organizer of the legendary Concert in the Park in 85, consulted with Paul Simon on the multiple platinum Graceland album, and continues to make music with his label Rhythm Safari. I've known Hilton for many years and regard him as one of the leading successful independent thinkers in the global music business. So it is a great pleasure to welcome from Sydney, Australia, Hilton Rosenthal to From the Hip. How's it, Hilton?
Hey, Benz, it's great to see you, and your check's in the mail.
Now, where were you born?
I was born in Joey's in Cyril Dean.
We're around about the same age, right?
Similar vintage.
Very vintage. When you were growing up, was music part of your life? I mean, when did you become aware of music as kind of an influence on you?
It's kind of weird. I was about 2 years old and my parents went to Europe and left me with my grandmother. And I suppose in some way to console me, she played me I Love Paris probably 20 times a day. My first appearance was probably a year later in Margate at the beach, at that amphitheater beach where I actually won the talent contest as a little twerp singing I Love Paris. Obviously got some sympathy votes. But that was the beginning. But we couldn't afford a piano, and my parents bought me a piano accordion when I was about 7 or 8. I learned that pretty seriously, not playing the typical South African traditional version of it, but, you know, playing everything from Zorba the Greek to classics and whatever. I think there might have been 6 entrants, but I won the South African under 12 piano accordion championships.
So you got those 2 ticks to your name. You cracked it at the beach in Margate and you cracked it in the talent competition. It kind of set you up for the future, I think. Were you listening to the radio back then, buying records? What were you hearing when you were growing up?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, everything from not quite then, but certainly as I got older. Listening obviously to the Beatles and the Stones, everything pop from Herman's Hermits to it was a total mixed bag. I was never really locked into one genre, let's put it that way. But, you know, I was listening to LM Radio. You know, there wasn't that much else. Springbok Radio, the Radio Record Club with Peter Lotus was one of our new release kind of places to hear things. But most of my taste was honed at Barry Gordon's record store in Killarney.
Oh, wow.
A chap called Kenny Cohen. I used to, every time I walked in, Kenny would go, "Hey, you know, I've got something for you." I'll never forget, I was standing there in my shorts from school one afternoon, and he said, "I got to play you something." And he put on Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills. Now, I'd already been a fan of Crosby, Stills, but when that a cappella came on in the middle of Carry On, I literally threw the headphones down, ran the 3 blocks to my parents' apartment, begged and cried for 5 rand to go back and buy the album.
So that was kind of like your light switch moment where you kind of, wow, this is it. I get it.
Yeah, well, there were times before, but that's one very memorable moment where, those harmonies just blew me away.
But I mean, at that point, it wasn't in your mind that you were going to go into the music business. In fact, you studied to be an accountant, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, at school, I was in a band, a decent school band called Appetites Temptation. Guess where we got the name? We put a bottle of All Gold Tomato Sauce on the drums. I mean, it was so crazy kitschy, but it gave me an experience to sit. We used to play at socials around Joburg, and I had no intention. I really didn't know where I wanted to be other than I loved music. I wanted to play music. I thought I could be a musician. Changed my mind a little later. Well, I was playing in a duo called Hilton and Howard, which was the Simon and Garfunkel days. Our gigs, the regular gigs each week were the Skyline Hotel bar on a Monday night. And one of the Robinson Lake and those places with Al Debo, etc., on a Sunday. And Thursday evenings, we kind of wandered around. So during my university days, I actually made more money than most of my mates that were working full time. I went to Wits, studied BCom. The plan was, I had an eye surgery when I was in Form 4. I had a detached retina, which was a very unusual thing in those days. And for 3 months, literally, I had to lie on my back with both eyes covered. And that was really where music carried me through. Unfortunately, not a Walkman, but certainly somebody was putting on records for me and I was listening to music. But so I didn't go to the army and I was young for my year. So I thought I'd be a BCom CA MBA by the age of about 22 and see what happened. But at the end of second year, I was working for my dad's accountants and they had me doing an audit where all I did all day was tick cards and write lists of people who hadn't paid bills, et cetera, et cetera. And our agent in those days was Morris Fresco. And Morris called me one day and said, "What are you doing? There's a gig on the Principe Fito traveling around for 3 weeks to Mauritius, Madagascar, Seychelles, etc. And we'll give you X $1,000, which was more money than I'd ever heard of in my life before." And next minute I was out of accountancy and I was on the boat singing, playing for half an hour a day and going crazy the rest of the time. I finished my BCom, but it put paid to the accountancy thing.
What a vibe. Talking the early 70s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. 69 to 72.
It was a hotbed of social activism and consciousness that was happening.
Absolutely.
A lot of music.
Free people's concerts.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Did you go to those shows?
I went to the shows. I wasn't involved in organizing. I think Dave Marks was probably the main guy doing that, but certainly went to a lot of the concerts while I was at Wits. In between standing on Jan Smuts Avenue and protesting and getting my chased with a baton, et cetera, et cetera. That was where I actually originally saw Johnny and Sipo at the Wits Great Hall. Never had any thought of doing anything with them at that stage, but, basically I was at that concert where Sipo stomped and fell through the floor into the orchestra pit.
They were very rootsy at that particular. It was more folky, rootsy kind of thing that they were doing. So despite getting a BCom, you didn't go into that, which I don't know whether your parents were disappointed with that or not. You joined GRC. How did that come about?
A mate of mine's father was one of the big industrialists in town who owned a big company. And he kept nagging me to go and work for him. And I just didn't feel like it was the place I wanted to be. I just felt, in any case, I didn't want to work for friends. And one night, we were studying for final year at Wits. And he walked in and he said, "Well, are you coming to work for us?" And I said, "Actually, no." And he went, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "Why don't you phone Arnold Galemba at GRC? I know your dad knows him." My dad had bought me my first 11 guitar, an acoustic guitar from Arnold. And so I called up and I said, "Listen, I want to come talk." So we had a chat. The first thing he said was, "So what do you want to do, my boy? Do you want to do accounting? Do you want to do A&R, marketing?" I said, "What's A&R?" He told me what it was. I said, "That sounds like a good idea." So, we had a good chat. And at the end, he said to me, "Look, we're a really small company. We don't have a job for you right now. But let me talk to David Fine, who at that time was the CEO of Gallo. GRC was part of the Gallo group. I'll call you back." So they called back about a couple of weeks later. And I went to have a meeting with Arnold and David. And they said, "Look, we really feel like we need to put somebody in here to learn the business. We don't, we're very thin on the ground. And maybe as a long-term succession plan, you know, you should come in. But the only job we have for you right now is as an accountant. So I spent my first year in a general office with seven ladies. Basically, my main function was handling the payment of royalties and payment of session fees for the black musicians, which is really where I started falling in love with music I'd never heard before. You know, I'd heard it on the radio when The Maid was playing it, you know, when we were kids, but it was something we never really gave any thought to. And the fact that I handled the accounting side of things really stood me in good stead. I mean, to this day, I can look at a royalty statement and in 2 minutes tell you if there's something wrong or not.
The Galembos are legendary in the music business. While you were upstairs, I was downstairs at Gallo on the third floor, 7-Eleven right. guitars and Fenders and everything as well. And Jack Bloch was there and Dave Bowman, all of them. In fact, Dave Bowman fired me because I refused to cut my hair. So we were both kind of, you know, we were both in the same building, unbeknownst.
I actually didn't know you at that stage.
No. I think it was Derek Mars was the guy there at CBS.
Well, and, Alan McGuinness was the head of A&R.
At that time, you started developing and leaning towards A&R, and you started to sign artists.
At the end of the year, you know, Arnold had said to me, look, spend a year in the accounts department. We'll see what we can find for you. The end of the year, I went to him. I said, look, man, I'm going crazy. You know, Alan was great. He would let me come and sit in on sessions. Obviously, when the black musicians were recording, I was in the studio a lot of the time. So that gave me the taste for the studio side of things. You know, I would say that my taste for quote unquote A&R or, you know, the love of music had developed pretty much long before that. But Arnold said, look, I just don't have a job for you. Do you have any ideas? And I said to him, well, your black music division is a mess. It's basically just throwing a lot of stuff at the wall. It's very, very, you know, unplanned. And in fact, you're paying the guys R5 a side, being R5 a song,
wow,
as the session fee. All they're doing is rehearsing and coming in and doing one take of everything and maximizing the number of songs they can record in a day. There was once they were up. Processed payments for 35 songs in a single day because the guys were getting $5 a side. So I said to him, you know, I think you could really structure this. Gallo had started that with Papi, and I saw what they were doing. And I said, look, you know, I think we can do this and probably do it better. So he said, write a business plan, which I did. And he said, look, okay, you're now general manager of Isibaya Music, but it's not a full-time job. So why don't you spend the rest of the time with Alan in the A&R and marketing department? And just get to learn things. So I did that. And I mean, I think, you know, you and I probably are, you know, few people in the world that have done almost every job in a record company.
Yeah.
You know, it's apart from the accounting and the, you know, that side of things, I went and pressed records when there was a strike at the steel factory.
Yeah, me too.
Went around putting up posters in the record stores, went to radio with Debbie Thwaites.
I remember Debbie.
It was an incredible incredible education. And in fact, even during that time, I was writing some stuff and I played Alan some songs one day. And he said, you know what, why don't you come into the studio? We'll do a single with you while the guys, we're paying the guys for 3 hours. We'll take 15 minutes and record a single, which we did, which I proudly know that no one ever heard, I don't think. And then one day, Friday afternoon, Alan said to me, what are you doing this weekend? I said, oh, nothing really. Why? And he said, well, it's Kyalami and someone just gave me tickets to go to the motor racing. And I've got this band coming up from Durban. They do covers and whatever. And I was going to produce an album over the weekend with them. So why don't you do it? So I went, well, okay. You know, we sat in the studio. I had a very rude awakening, not realizing, you know, all the intricacies that I was drinking a can of Coke. Left it on the mixing desk, tried to wave to the artists to tell them what to do, and I bumped the can of Coke over, and we spent a couple of hours replacing some channels in the mixing desk. So that was my first experience.
Could have been your last by knocking it into the desk. The first time I became aware of you was when you signed and produced Penny Croft, who was this very interesting artist, not quite straight pop, more kind of quirky. She had that big single. What was it called? Count the Red Cars. What attracted you to her as an artist?
There's an in-between step, which was that a couple of months later, Alan left and went to EMI.
That's right, yeah.
You know, just 2 months before my 22nd birthday, Arnold gave me the job of head of A&R and marketing. So that was when I started having the freedom to sign artists. I think the first single that I produced and signed was Don Stanton, Strong, Strong Wind, and then Sammy Brown, Storybook Children, et cetera, et cetera. It was a great time in the industry because, you know, there was no pressure. It was a cheap risk, should we say, to go in and produce a single here and there. I mean, I wasn't doing it just, but then I came across Penny, and I suppose we would have called her partially something like a singer-songwriter. She was English. Her dad was David Croft, who was one of the producers or directors of Are You Being Served, I think, one of the big British sitcoms. My first probably serious artist that we went into the studio, we had some great times. We had a single, the hit single with Count the Red Cars, but the album didn't do that much. And we did a second album, but thereafter, I think Penny left and went back to England.
Perhaps I've loved the road too long, my suitcase lost as me. Every town has got its magic, but it's just a town, you see. Another place to sing in, another frightened crowd. Will they love me? Will they see me? Will I sing too long, too loud? As I hide behind my confidence, I drink a toast to home. If I knew where I was toasting, then I wouldn't feel alone. Hair shines with careful brilliance, reflects a dress that I design. So many towns, so many songs, so many games to pass the time. Count the red cars, count the lunch bars, count the buses, count the beer, count the freeways, count the cafes, count the fish that you will hear. Count the cities, count the countries, count the end of the rain. Count the why can I stop loving you? What's your girlfriend's name? What's your girlfriend's name? To bare my soul, another bass drum plays a wrong beat, and I think I've got a cold. There's an ice cream stand at the end of the pier that would really blow your mind, but it's no fun tasting loneliness, so I think I'll stick to wine. Perhaps you'll see me on TV, perhaps I'm singing just for you. Perhaps you'll see me in 6,000 weeks, and that'll happen. Do count the red cars, count the lunch bars, count the buses, count the beer, count the freeways, count the cafes, count the wish that you were here, count the cities, count the countries, count the animals.
You were wearing two hats at that point. You were head of A&R and you'd moved into production, and you don't have a sound engineering background. No. Which is sometimes a prerequisite for being a good producer. Was it having a vision of what the overall end result on a record would sound like? Is that what motivated you to go into production?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, firstly, you know, Hilton and Howard had three failed record deals. They were in the process of signing to Graham Beggs. And I can't remember why, but that fell through before we made any recordings. And then Terry Dempsey signed us and actually did a single, Love, Peace and Happiness. And in fact, in the studio, again, this was great, great education for me. This was during the time when I think I was still in the accounting department. The band that Terry put together to back us was just unbelievable. Trevor Rabin was one of his first sessions, I think a 16-year-old guitarist. Kevin Kruger on drums, I think Nippy Cripple on bass. It was an amazing experience. And we thought the record came out and sounded great, but Terry never released it. We then hooked up with Pat Van Blerk, who did a couple of things with us, and that never worked. So I think the fact that I'd been on the side of the artist gave me an empathy and an artistic kind of perspective on the business as well.
The relationship with producer and artist is kind of cemented with engineer. I mean, you worked with some really good people over long periods of time. Zane Cronier on the Penny Croft stuff, but the crazy Bobby Summerfield, yeah. Peter Thwaites. I mean, that relationship has to work if you're going to get a record,
an
album done, you know.
Yeah, did many albums with Peter, both at Gallo and then at the Sackbell Studios when he moved over there. Did a couple of albums. In fact, I did the Scatlings album with Richard Mitchell. at RPM. Both those relationships became long-term friendships. When I left GRC and formed my own company, I met Bobby, and ever since then, he's probably engineered just about everything I've done. We're still very close friends.
He's a great little producer. That was when you formed Music and Mink, right? And when you left,
yeah.
When you left
Music
GRC,
yeah.
You signed two of the hottest club bands at that time, which was City Limits,
yeah,
and
that
Fantasy.
Was my first release. Fantasy was at GRC still. In fact, City Limits
came
out of
Fantasy.
Oh,
it was Fantasy at GRC.
Yeah, because at GRC, some of the other things when around the Fantasy time also did that Eloise Concerto when 12 inches were the thing.
I remember that. Was
Zane.
That John Wedderpol on vocals there?
Dennis East did the vocals. The day we were about to release the record, Matt Mann called up Arnold and said, "I'm going to sue you because you're using one of my artists," as, you know, even though he wasn't a featured vocalist. So spent that weekend redoing the album with John and released it a week later.
City Limits are amazing. I mean, they were like a pop supergroup. I mean, they were all phenomenal players. The late Rick Wolf, who unfortunately passed away.
Beautiful musicians. In fact, John and I hooked up recently. He's living in near Byron Bay here in Australia, and I didn't know it.
He
and,
is.
We kind of had a couple of chats a couple of weeks ago. But, of course, the link was that Chris Galakis was in Fantasy and City Limits was his sort of next band, and that, well, you know, the one moved into the other.
You were quite varied in what you were signing at Minka. I mean, you did People Like Us, the huge high-energy band that appealed to the gay market. And were, I think globally they had some big hits.
Yeah, Midnight Lover is still a very solid anthem.
People
in the
Like
clubs.
Us.
People Like Us, yeah. That was quite a bit later.
But you also signed a very early edition of Mango Groove.
That's right. I did a 12-inch with John and Claire just before I sold the company to EMI and moved overseas.
What makes you sign an artist? Commerciality? Is it creativity? Is it because you like it or you think it'll work?
A combination of all. Firstly, I've got to love the music. Commerciality has to come into it. You know, we're running a business. It's a relationship between the producer and or label and the artist that that really is what carries a lot of weight as well.
Well, I think that kind of attitude of loving the music is something that made the industry great. Unfortunately, and I don't know if you agree, but nowadays it's less of an issue and more about the numbers. I mean, I don't think I ever signed anyone in my career that I didn't like. And some of them were very obscure and non-commercial, but I signed them because I loved them and I thought that they needed to be heard.
I think that's a very valid thing. Yeah, you and I grew up, you know, in the era where if you signed an artist, you could actually, you know, you signed them for 3 to 5 years or 3 to 5 albums. And if the first one didn't work, you tried again and you tried again. Today, it's all about what are the TikTok numbers and, you know, what's your Spotify streams before the, you know, that's how the majors are doing A&R. They're not really, you know, they're not doing the sort of stuff that we used to do.
Well, A&R, as you said, is TikTok and YouTube. I mean, I signed Falling Mirror, did 5 albums and only one of them ever broke even. The rest of them lost money, but that wasn't the point, was it? It was great music. So
absolutely.
In 78, you signed Johnny and Sipa as Jaluka.
Yeah.
And you had already seen them at VIT. What was the turning point where you went, okay, I'm going to do something with this?
Because of my relationship working with the black musicians. And, you know, I was one of the first people to do an album when the Soul Brothers landed on my desk with 5 different singles. And I thought, what are we doing with this? And, you know, the guys were on tour. And I basically fell in love with it and just put an album together. And, you know, I fell in love with a lot of that music. And I had this absolute yearning to mix the music that I'd grown up with and that I loved with this new love of black music. So that was my vision. And I spoke to Hamilton and Zimandi and to a number of the artists who were, you know, in our black music division, but nobody got it. We experimented a little bit and it went very, very quickly nowhere. Arnold passed away. And Alan Davis, who was head of international at CBS, came out and had a chat. And he said, look, you know, you're 26 years old. You're probably our next in line to run this business. But we've always promised Arnold's brother, Percy, that if he carried on and ran our business in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, that we would bring him here. We would let him move over. Are you okay with that? We'll make you general manager and him CEO. And I said, that's great, but I do want a favor from you. I said, I need to have a budget to do one project that I love that I would never get permission from the Gallo Group to do. I don't know what that project is yet. Will you authorize that as part of my acceptance of the situation? That just came out of my mouth while we were sitting talking. And then, you know, I started really trying to work out what it was. And I was sitting at home one Sunday night. I said to my wife, you know, I'm getting so frustrated. I'm just getting nowhere with this project. A light flashed in my mind, and I remembered Johnny and Sipo. So I walked to my study, and I opened the drawer, and at the top of the drawer was the Juluka program from 1973 adverts. And I thought, wow, you know, Johnny's mom had previously worked for GRC as a PRO. And she left just before I joined. She always came in, you know, came in often. And I, you know, we were all rolling our eyes. My son, Johnny, can you introduce him to Mort Lewis, Simon and Garfunkel's manager? And Arnold will go, yes, sure, Muriel, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I was aware of Muriel and I was aware of Johnny. And I literally picked up the telephone directory and looked up Muriel Pinar on a Sunday evening at 8. You know, we had a chat and she said, what do you want? And I said, look, I really would like to talk to John about doing a project. She said, what do you want to do? I explained, you know, it was basically a mixture of stuff. She said, he's actually got a meeting with Warners tomorrow. They want to sign him. I said, okay, well then, you know, I'll find something else. And she said, no, but they want him to record Zulu traditional music. And I think what you want to do is much more interesting. So I'm going to tell him to just hold off and come and see you. So we had this meeting at GRC, and the two of us through the years have described totally different experiences. You know, for me, this crazy wild bushman walked in and he's, you know, he was on his way to do his 6 weeks of research in Zululand to complete his thesis for his anthropology degree. So this big, huge bush of hair and this big beard and his cargo pants, you know, he looked like African Crocodile Dundee, basically. we had a chat. His perspective was, I walked into this office and there was this bagel sitting there on this big plush leather couch. And I thought, how the hell am I ever going to deal with this guy? Anyway, you know, half an hour of conversation later, he said, look, when I come back from Zululand, we'll have a chat and see if we can take it forward, which we did. And we signed. It was Johnny and Sipo at that point in time. Mm. I'll never forget the, you know, the signing ceremony in our boardroom at GRC. Sipo sitting at the end of this long table, an illiterate gardener who was the smartest person I ever met, just about. You know, he put his thumbprint on the contract, which was the way he signed, and he lifted his hand like this and went, something. And that became our rallying cry. Every time something good happened, John Sipo and I would say, something.
That's such an amazing story. I mean, their blend of Zulu Maskanda and Umbagakanga with Celtic tinge folk and rock, it was very unique.
Totally.
In 81, it found a broader audience, although you did struggle at radio, didn't you?
It wasn't just at radio. You know, the production process there was that I felt they needed a band right from the start. I was doing something else at Sackville, I can't even remember what, and I booked one of the rehearsal rooms there and put them in the room with Gilly Matthews on drums and Sipo Gumede on bass. And I just said, guys, I'll come and see you at 5 o'clock. Just play music. And when I walked in, I went, something's happening here, which is just amazing, you know. I had a budget now. This was my budget, but it certainly wasn't a huge budget. Everything was done very organically. The band played live together. Then we did the overdubs, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost my favorite record of all time, Universal Men. I took it to our sales meeting and played it to the guys and got blank stares.
I have undone this distance so many times before that it seems as if this life of mine is trapped between two shores. As the little ones grow older on the station platform, I shall undo that distance just once more. My brothers and my sisters have been scattered in the wind, dressed in cheap horizons which have never quite fitted. And for centuries they've traveled on a pale phantom ship, sailing for that shore which has no other shore.
Mit die Drogen der Name.
Du mal lasch ich den Balabo.
Mit die Drogen der Name.
Du mal lasch ich den Fiao.
Mit die Drogen der Name.
Du mal lasch ich den Balabo.
What is this? It's too white for blacks. It's too black for whites. You're crazy. I said, okay. So then, you know, I started talking to people and everybody, a lot of people were giving me the same kind of looks and comments. I had a good relationship with Swazi Radio at the time, which couldn't really break a record, but I took it up to Mishma Petla at Swazi with my big Ampex reel of tape. And I put it on in his little cubicle and I played him Africa and he burst into tears. And I went, okay. I think we've got something. I have no idea how we're going to sell it, but, you know, I've got some validation finally.
A great radio man, Mishma Petla. Oh.
SABC was a total waste of time. The library wouldn't even take the record in because it was mixing languages and, you know, their policy was apartheid. We can't have Zulus singing in English and English people singing African languages, et cetera, et cetera. And it was the dawn of Capital Radio. I think it was Anthony Took who was program director at the beginning, right? I basically played him the record. He loved it. And he said, this is going to be our first number one record. So Capital launched and we thought, wow, it's going to be the number one record. No one told Capital that their transmitters weren't working properly and about four people could hear it. So, you know, yes, we had a number one record on Capital Radio, but it really meant absolutely nothing. And this coincided anyway with a period where there was some corporatization going on at Gallows and I wasn't agreeing with everything that was going on and I was kind of getting antsy and wanted to leave. And there was an incident on a Friday afternoon with the corporate guys and on the Monday morning I walked in and resigned. And I said, look, to Percy, I mean, I was very, very close to Percy. I said, I don't have a job. I don't have anything else going right now, but I'm telling you, it's the 1st of October. I'm leaving the end of December. And I said, but I want to, the one condition is that I want to continue producing Jamaica. We agreed on that. And then I went out and started looking for funding. It's another story for another day. But opened Mink on the 2nd of January in 1980. You know, I had City Limits as my first band. And I had did a deal with Wilson and Lovu, Sathi and Lovu, who was an incredibly talented producer. He made some good records and we just couldn't get it going. For a year, we really, really struggled. I mean, the City Limits, I managed to push onto the charts. We got some play. We got the single, Shouldn't Fall in Love, onto the charts. Again, couldn't really get the album moving, released a couple of other singles. Rick Wolf's song, Miracle, was just one of my favorite all-time records and songs. Then what happened was that Percy came to me. I did a distribution deal with GRC when I started the label. And Percy came to me and he said to me, look, as a friend, I'm telling you, I think these guys are pushing anything of yours. I think there's a bit of jealousy, the fact that you've left the company and now you're wanting us to sell your stuff. If you want out, you know, we'll just tear up the contract. I said, will you sell me Jaluka's contract? He said, yes. So I did a deal with EMI to distribute. Immediately, we started getting a pickup in sales, and we started planning the African Litany album, which is really when things started breaking.
I remember it exploding. I mean, I remember, you know, African Sky Blue, and of course, Impi. I mean, you know, it's gone on to be ingrained in the psyche of this country. You hear it at every sporting event. I mean, I go to parties and, you know, people are sitting around and doing nothing, and an MP comes on and everybody leaps up of all colors and creeds, you know, dance around feverishly singing MP. I mean, when you recorded that, did you think it was going to be that big?
No, I just knew it was extraordinary. Let's put it that way. My choice, the first single, was African Sky Blue, and that was what we released. The band had, you know, had started playing, and they were doing live gigs, and they were getting some response, and we were starting to, you know, things were starting to sell at least.
African Sky Blue, your children wait for the dawn. African Sky Blue, soon a new day will be born. African Sky Blue, African Sky Blue, will you bless my life? African sunshine, soon you will warm your children's eyes. The African river water will dance and leap in your morning light. African sunshine, African river water, will you bless my life? Oh, will you bless my life? Oh, will you bless my life? Oh, will you bless my life? What can I know?
I think by that time, we sold a couple of thousand of Universal Men. That was word of mouth and press mainly, and live shows. All of a sudden, I get a call from one of the guys at EMI to say, something's going on with MP. Effectively putting the word out and finding out, you know, we discovered that it was becoming the anthem of the Toy Toy guys in, you know, in the townships, which is really, you know, the Zulu warriors beating the white man, basically, was where it started. We won the record of the year on Radio Zulu without them ever playing the record.
Was SABC not playing it at that?
SABC, no. Radio Zulu wouldn't play anything mixing Zulu and English music. In fact, I mean, I got to tell you that radio in South Africa was probably by far the smallest reason why Jaluka and Savuka, Johnny Clegg, became what they did. You know, it was always word of mouth, media, live shows, et cetera, et cetera. And it just grew and grew and grew. Crazy irony for me was when Vodafone called and said, look, we want to use Impi as a campaign for the Springboks.
Impi, wonan simpieza, uvani benga chincha mabubesi. Impi, wonan simpieza, Ubani benga chinja mabubesi. Impi, konan simpiesa. Ubani benga chinja mabubesi. Impi, konan simpiesa. Ubani benga chinja mabubesi.
Ubani benga chinja mabubesi.
have thought, two of the most unlikely records that I was involved in, because the one thing we didn't talk about, I never produced, but I released the Klaxons.
The clapping song.
That became the biggest record in the country. I mean, Dave Gresham phoned me one Saturday at lunchtime and said, and I did a promotion today at Hypermarket. I did not sell a single record, and every woman walked out with a packet of Mari biscuits and the Klaxons record. But the crazy thing was that the Klaxons became, you know, an anthem at the rugby as well. I mean, you'd go to the rugby games, and afterwards, that's all you would hear in the car park. And then MP.
Well, I mean, MP, you must be so proud of it, because you hear it everywhere, and you hear it.
Yeah.
I've heard it in LA. I've heard it in London. I've heard it. Funnily enough, at Isandlwana, because I'm a big scholar of the Anglo-Zulu War.
Right.
So I go to Isandlwana
right.
every January. Then in the late 80s.
Yeah, 83 was when Scatterlings broke in England.
Third World Child came out, Great Heart, Scatterlings of Africa.
Yeah, that was Savuka,
At this stage, were you and Johnny focusing on developing a pop sound that would appeal internationally, or was it kind of an organic thing?
Combination of the two. I mean, we did Universal Men, African Litany, Scatterlings, two albums, Buhle Bemvelo and Musa Kangalandelai, and then Work for All. And Scatterlings album was signed by Warner's in the States, put out by Safari Records in England, who had the hit. But in North America, we signed to Warner's. Great moment for me was when I took the record over. Seymour Stein called me, actually, and said he'd heard it, and he was talking to Lenny Waronker at Warner's, and that I should go and see Lenny. You know, they wanted to sign Chaluka. First thing I did was I said, look, you know, let's listen to Scatterlings of Africa, the song. Big Zulu hums came on and whatever. And Lenny went, man, I love these African voices. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that these African voices was Clegg Rosenthal, Johnny Boshoff, Gary Van Zyl, as well as Sipho and a bunch of real African voices. In fact, that was the beginning of the relationship where we ended up. With Graceland. You know, Lenny once said to me later, Graceland was the album that we thought Scatterlings could be.
I mean, Seymour always had an ear for something different.
Yeah, absolutely.
He made a pitch for Mango, and
right.
so did Atlantic.
And
Atlantic pushed up the money, and Seymour said, I'm only going to pay this, but I guarantee you I'll make it a priority. But unfortunately, the powers that be that controlled the Mango thing at that time said, no, we'll go for the money. Speaking of the studio and working in the studio, how did that process unfold? Were there fully fledged demos to work with, or some of it evolve in the studio while you were working? Did you track live? Were there first takes? What was a typical recording session?
The first album, all the songs were ready before we went in the studio. So it was a matter of rehearsing, going in, recording organically. African Litany was actually where we had Johnny Boshoff do actual arrangements of the songs. So the songs, again, were complete before the studio. Not complete when I first heard them, but, you know, John and I had worked the stuff through and then met with Johnny and said, look, this is what we want you to do. And he wrote out the parts and we recorded that way. So, again, it was recorded predominantly live. One day the band was rehearsing and I walked in and Johnny said, I've got to play you something. And he sat down and he played the guitar. None of the band had heard it yet. He said, I'm working on this song called Scatterlings of Africa. And he played the guitar and he played the song. And I went, it's amazing, but God, your time signatures are all over the place. He said, what's a time signature? He's like, oh, that's what I feel. So yes, there's a 9-8 bar and a 7-4 bar and a this and a that. But, you know, I said to him, well, I don't know how are we going to work this out? And this was one of those examples where it literally started from the ground up and worked itself through in the studio. The first day we went in with a click track, Zola played the kick drum and the hi-hat. That's all, because we didn't know where to put the snare, literally. It took hours and hours, but we got a great feel. And then John put on a demo vocal, and we said to Gary Van Zyl, do me a favor, go home and work out a bass line. And there was some serious genius there with Gary. He came in and he put on the bass line that really tied most of the stuff together and gave us a situation where in the choruses, at least, you know, we had a place to put snares.
Right.
And, you know, we had, by accident as well, those big African doo-doo toms had, you know, had come out through an idea of mine with Impey. And it became a signature of ours. So we decided, well, we'll put the toms on. And then John played the final guitar and each instrument was added on top. And I said to Johnny, you know, I think if we're really going for this, your signature is the toms and the Zulu hums. Can you put together a Zulu section of the humming? It literally happened in the studio. Everything was layered, put on top, etc. And again, when it was finished, that then we really knew something.
Stallions and fugitives, hooded eyes and weary brows, seek refuge in the night. They are the scatterings of Africa, each uprooted one.
One on my ear,
they're on the road to Bella Mamba, where the world began. I love the scatterings of Africa, each and everyone.
Oh, mama, yeah.
In their hearts a burning hunger beneath the copper sun. Broken war, bicycle wheel, African song forging steel, singing magic machine cannot match human being, human being. African ideas, African ideas, make the future clear, make the future clear. They are the scatterings of Africa, each uprooted one.
One on my head.
You had it all ready, and then there was just the fairy dust on top that made it all come together.
Yeah.
You and Johnny obviously work very, very closely in the studio.
Very closely in the studio, very closely, you know, I mean, we're basically best mates for 40 years. Yeah, John was literally the smartest person anyone could have ever met. And I, you know, I can still picture nights at like 1 a.m. where he's talking to me about subatomic physics that he's just discovered, that he's reading. He could read 6 books at a time and remember every word. And, you know, like 1 a.m. after a bottle of wine, he's going, well, you know, this building and this concrete and the subatomic physics. And I'm going, please go home. So
he was a very, very intelligent man. I had several intense conversations about those kind of things. The combined success of the albums, the pressures of recording, the constant touring, the business of the brand Clegg, must have weighed heavily on you both at some point. Did you ever feel that burnout was going to be, or overexposure was going to be a problem?
Not overexposure. I mean, you know, Sipo told us just before we made the Work for All album that he had decided he wanted to go home and complete his father's vision, which was for him to rebuild the family homestead, and that he had enough money to go and he was going home to build a school, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, I'll give you a year. And that was a time when, in fact, we had been called by CBS Records, by Rick Chertoff, who had the number one record at the time with Cyndi Lauper. And Rick said, look, you know, I want to sign you guys and I want to produce the next album. And John and I got on a plane on a Sunday night. He had a gig on the Wednesday. New York on the Monday, spent the day talking, discovered that CBS's business affairs guys were talking I don't want to be rude. I said to him, look, you know, I was on the Council of Europe. I used to go to the managing director's meetings. Don't tell me that this is what people pay intercompany and therefore you can pay us Y minus or divided by 10. And literally we walked out and left. Rick at the time told us that, you know, Cyndi and her band, the band, the Hooters, were backing her on that tour, listened to Scatlings every single night on the tour bus. And in fact, ultimately ended up with a lifelong friendship with Eric Bazillion from the Hooters, who spent weeks with us when we were doing Heat, Dust, and Dreams and played mandolin and some guitar. At that point, there was a mini burnout. You know, John knew that Juluka was down. South Africa was, this is now 1985, really the darkest times. And John said to me, look, I don't want to do anything. I got to walk away from this for a while. And then slowly he came back and he said, you know, why not I'm listening to some other really totally different stuff. And without putting a record out or doing anything, I just want to make a solo album. So we went in the studio and experimented with really a pop record. And I said to him, look, if you want to do something different, we should probably put some female vocals on as well. And we did the album, which was called Third World Child, released it, but nothing was really going on with it. They had already had a lot of interest from France. They'd gone over to France and Germany to do some cultural shows and, you know, just Johnny and Sipo. One of the French labels put out the Ubuntu Bemvelo Zulu album, coined the phrase Le Zulu Blanc at the time. Slowly, John was getting more energized again. We decided that, okay, we should put a new band together, which should include a female vocalist. It should include more synths, not just be guitar-based, be a bit more poppy, but still try and maintain that crossover. And so we used a couple of songs from the solo album, redid them. He decided that the band should do a show at the Market Theatre. So they booked the Market Theatre, I think, for a week or 2 weeks. They were rehearsing at what became Trillion Studios. It was an old movie house in Orange Grove. And it was a similar moment like the day at Scatlings where he sat down and he said, I've got something I want to play you. And I can still picture him sitting on the stage with his guitar and he sang the Asimbananga. And I went, I have no idea what our plans are, but we're going to the studio tomorrow to capture exactly what you're doing right now. That whole recording was done in a couple of hours almost, because the band had rehearsed it and it was just, again, just something amazing. And we knew that something, it's Impi Scatlings and Asimbananga that are the three moments for me that were the stepping stones to everything else.
Asimbananga,
Asimbananga, Mandela Jina, Lape Kona, Lape Feli Kona.
Asimbananga,
Asimbananga, Mandela Jina, Lape Kona, Lape Feli Kona.
They got an invitation from the Angoulême Festival in France to go and play at Angoulême. There was a French guy that called me and said, look, you know, I can get them this gig at Angoulême, and I'd like to use the band in Europe. And his name was Claude Six. And Claude was really, you know, he understood the French market. He understood what was happening with France at that time. So the band goes and plays Angoulême. And the next morning, the front page of the main newspaper in the country shows a picture of François Mitterrand's wife dancing on her chair in the front row at the Savuka concert. This ignited excitement, people wanting them to tour, multiple people calling. That was when I got calls from John Craig in London to say, you know, we should do something, et cetera, et cetera. And again, now that coincided with my time decision to leave South Africa. Mm. So I didn't know what I was going to do. Paul Simon, who suggested that I go and speak to Lenny and I should move to LA, even though I put my papers in to come to Australia because my wife was a speech therapist and could get in here. And on the way, I signed Savuka to EMI in London, the new era, effectively. Now we were with major label worldwide, next stage ready.
Now, both Gianluca and Savuka were different animals. Did production process differ between them?
Again, different in early days. You know, in the earlier days, it differed in the sense that there was less organic stuff. You know, Asimbananga worked because it was organic. We went in and did it. Great Heart, we did it that way. Once the band was on the road and touring the way they were, there was very little time for Johnny to complete songs. So, you know, a lot of the time he would sit at sound checks and say to the band, hey, I've got this idea, and they'd work around some kind of backing. And almost from certainly the Third World Child album and the Heat, Dust and Dreams album were lots of the songs where we cut the tracks first and then he wrote the lyrics or finalized, you know, he had an idea of what the lyrics were, but had finalized the lyrics and then came up with the melodies, et cetera, et cetera. It was a process which did change based on circumstances.
How did Great Heart come about? Because that's such an amazing song.
He had a call from the producers of the Jocko the Bushveld movie to say, we're looking for someone to write a theme. So he said, I'll do it for you for nothing as long as we own the song and the recording and we'll license it to you. That was a much more organic thing because he wrote the song, the band rehearsed it, and you know, we went into the studio and recorded it.
Every man has to be his own savior. I know I can make it on my own if I try, but I'm searching for a great heart to stand me by underneath the African sky. A great heart to stand me by.
I'm searching for the spirit of the great heart.
You hold.
The heavens, there's a whispering song of the wind in the grass, there's a rolling thunder across the savannah, a hope and a dream at the edge of the sky, and your life is a story like the wind, your life is a story like the wind.
I'm searching for the spirit of the great heart.
And you still hear it on radio. I mean,
yeah.
At some stage, Johnny closed the book on that, on bands.
Yeah.
And decided to pursue being a solo artist. Were you acting as management then, or did you have separate management?
It was an interesting situation because he asked me very early on, would I manage him? And I said, look, I'm your producer, your record label, and your publisher. It is an absolute conflict of interest for me to actually be your manager as well. But you can use my office and... Effectively, our office was a de facto management office for many, many years. In Europe, Claude was the manager. Mm-hmm. Once we moved to the States, spent a long, long time trying to find a manager. And again, my office all the way through the first couple of albums was the office that handled putting together the budgets, doing the basic stuff, finding a tour manager. But I still refused to be the guy that was negotiating on his behalf against myself. Eventually, we found different managers in the States. Some worked, some didn't.
Did Johnny feel that he had accomplished everything that he'd set out to do with bands before he went solo?
We had situations, two albums in a row while we were recording in LA, where he was called back to South Africa because a friend of his had been killed. First was David Webster and then Dudu.
Right.
And, you know, around that time when we were recording Heat, Dust and Dreams, I remember a meeting in the studio where he said to the guys, look, this album's coming out. We're going to tour for a year. Then it's done. Save your money. It's not carrying on. Please just hear my words. It's over, but let's do this tour and you can make as much money as possible. Again, at that point in time, he probably felt, yeah, I've accomplished what I want. And, you know, he was becoming very active with the South African Musicians Alliance. He was never overtly a political character, but he was a cultural activist in his own words. It took him a while before he started dabbling in making his own albums and producing his own albums.
Through all the days that eat away, and every breath that I take, through all the nights I have lain alone, someone else's dream awake. All the words in truth that were spoken, it's only you that remains with me, clear as the light of day.
So you didn't produce the solo albums?
No.
He did those on his own?
Yeah.
But you obviously remained friends?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was not, we lived on opposite ends of the world. I don't think there was ever a week that went by where we didn't talk.
86, Paul Simon released Graceland, which I think rejuvenated his flagging career. And it also catapulted South African music, Isikaremia and Mbakanga, onto the world stage. I think it's maybe a foregone conclusion that Paul had used elements of the Jaluka Savuka blueprint along with other South African influences to create that kind of palette with Graceland. What was your take on the Graceland phenomenon?
It started like this, as you probably had many times. The American executives had no clue that there was a different time zone in the rest of the world. My phone rings at 2:30 in the morning. I'm still in Joburg at this point in time, and hey, Hilton, can you hold for Lenny, please? So Lenny Waronker. So Lenny comes on the phone. How are you doing? He said, it's 2:30 in the morning. Well, but Paul Simon has found an African song, and he wants to talk to you. Do you mind if he calls you? It was a half a millisecond when I kind of thought, well, maybe, maybe not. And then I said, of course. So Paul called, and he said to me, look, I found this thing. It's a compilation tape somebody gave me. There's no J-card or anything in it. It's a copy of the cassette. It does say Zulu Accordion Jive Hits Volume 2. And it's the first track on side one. Can you do some research for me? Had to have been a Gallo record. I started talking to the guys at Gallo. Yes, they discovered that it was. And that the song was a song called Okungapeli by Masilela. So I phoned Paul back. I said, look, I've found the origins. What do you want? He said, I want to buy the 24 track from them so that I can work on top of it. So I started laughing. He said, what are you laughing about? I said, 24 track of those Mbakanga, recordings, they were all done on 2-track as quickly as possible. But I know most of the guys, we could probably put the band together again. So I said, that's an interesting thought. I said, what are you going to do with this? And he said, I have absolutely no idea. I said, why don't you make a South African album? How am I going to do that? I said, well, let me send you a bunch of stuff and we'll talk. Basically, I sent him about 30 albums. And he eventually called back and said, look, there's a couple of things I really love here. Can you book a studio and the musicians and let's put that together? Things that he had that he liked was Tawia Matsega, original, what became the Boyoyo Boys for the Gumboots track. Tawia Matsega became Boy in the Bubble. I Know One O, General MD Shirinda and the Gaza Sisters, who were signed to me. Stimela. He heard a couple of Stimela things. He said, I want to be in the studio with these guys. I don't know what, I haven't got a song. But when he arrived in the studio, he'd already done, he'd copied a couple of the Tawia Matsega tracks and said, look, I want this one to be, this groove to be the verse, and I want this groove to be the chorus. And I remember Ferreira sitting in the drum booth, not understanding a word, Koloi Lebona translating. And, Ferreira told us many years later that he wanted to do is hit Paul because Paul made him sit with his back to the wall and just play all day and told him, okay, now this is A, then he motioned, play B, and that became the verse and chorus of Boy in the Bubble. Then we did the track which became Crazy Love with Stimela. It was the end of the first week, and he said to me, what, you know, is there anybody we've forgotten? So we started talking. I said, you know, you never mentioned anything about Ladies with Black Lumbars. He said, I really don't know what to do with that. But he said, maybe we should put the best musos from the first week together as a backing band and go back into the studio and see how this works out. So we put Isaac and Charlie on, Spaghetti on bass, and Ray Peary on guitar. And we went into the studio on the Monday and started playing around. And in the middle of it all, Ray comes up with this dwee-dee-dee-doo, dwee-dee-dee-doo. They put together a track, sounded great. I used to pick him up every morning at the Sunnyside Park Hotel and drive him to the city to Ovation Studios. I got in the car the next day. I said to him, you recorded your first hit yesterday. He said, what are you talking about? I said, that song yesterday, that's a smash. He said, you know what? It's too commercial for me. I said, I'll buy it from you. He said, no, no, no. That week became an overdub week, and he left there with five complete backtracks. And then the balance morphed over the, you know, over the rest of the year, where they went to the US. The guys went back to the US to record some extra tracks. He went to Abbey Road in London to record Homeless. He called me the week before it was released. And he said, I don't know what I've done. He said, we've had listenings in New York and LA, and the response is really good. How's the rest of the world? It's, you know, LA and New York are these sophisticated markets. He had confessed to me at that time that, you know, Hearts and Bones, the previous album, had only sold 350,000, which was an abject failure for him, and that he was literally yearning for a hit. The rest is history.
A global phenomenon of Graceland opened so many doors, I think, for South African music. Do you think that it enhanced what Johnny was doing internationally as well?
The EMI deal probably might not have happened had Graceland not been a big hit at the time. For, you know, in terms of that, definitely. But I remember Paul calling me just before the, you know, when he finished the vocals on You Can Call Me Al. And he said, I want to use the word scatlings, but I know that that's a Johnny Clegg original word. Can you please talk to John and make sure that I've got permission to use it? And that moves towards your so-called cultural appropriation. He was very conscious of the fact that he was, you know, we talked on the first day on the way to the studio about how the South African musicians were going to get paid a share of copyrights when he based his songs on the originals. I basically negotiated those deals for the guys that day. That, you know, on principle, they would get X share of the song if he used the basic original backing, et cetera, et cetera. He said, I pay my musicians triple rates, which means triple what the average musician gets for a session musician. At the time in the States, I think it was $300 a three-hour session. And he said, he was actually a little pissed off because he said, you know, my musos that played for me on Bridge Over Troubled Water were $300. They were single session fees. When I came to record the next album, they said, you have to pay us triple session. He said, but you have triple session because of me. You know, he agreed that he would pay the South African musicians the same as his US musicians, which was a monstrous bump from what they were earning in South Africa at the time. There was no ill intent in terms of ripoff anywhere. You know, he was ultra conscious of that all the time.
Did Johnny and Paul have conversations about what was happening here? So I remember it being very tense politically here when Paul came back after putting the album together to do the tour, as you well know. That was Did Johnny and Paul get together and have conversations?
They spoke from time to time, but there was no kind of major dialogue as such. When we started doing the album, I had no idea. You know, I certainly knew about the cultural boycott, no question. You know, from what we knew, and you were born as you probably felt exactly the same at the time, the cultural boycott was about sport and live shows. No one had ever addressed the fact that people shouldn't record in South Africa. As it so happens, Paul did get an inkling because he was told in the States, you know, you should talk to Harry Belafonte before going. And Harry said, go and talk to the ANC. And he said, I'm not going like a school child to ask permission to do what I want to do. I'm going to make music and I'm going to go. When we finished the first week and we were thinking about additional artists to play on the record, I called in the guys from the Soul Brothers, Stanley and Kosi, and Moses Dlamini as you know, the managers of the Soul Brothers, and said, would you guys like to do it? And that was the first time where Stanley said, I've spoken to our people and we're not going to do it because of the cultural boycott. From there, it just grew and grew and grew. And obviously, by the time the album got released internationally, it became a big matter. I don't know. I think you and I, again, grew up in the world where any publicity is good publicity. And even though it was very negative, I don't think that harmed in any way the sales and the interest in Graceland.
It still stands as a great album and a testament to the power of South African music, because it's very much a South African album.
Absolutely.
I met Paul at Ovation while I was recording in the studio next door. He's quite a serious dude.
Yeah. Intense.
You moved to the States. You formed Rhythm Safari.
I moved in 87. Bobby came with me. When we did African Litany, I booked a promotion at the hypermarket on a Saturday morning. And I called a DJ company. I said, can you send me a DJ to do the promotion? And Bobby arrived. I don't think he'd slept the night before. Like this 19 or 20-year-old mad Englishman. Still says today, I looked at this and went, pinch me. I'm not in this real world. What the hell's going on here? These two Zulu guys dancing on a table in the middle of a supermarket. But then he became Chaluka's live engineer. I moved my Mink offices and built a studio, and he became my studio engineer. And then he came with me to the States.
On roller skates.
Yes.
I remember when I visited him in LA, he came to the door with his roller skates, and it was crazy. When you founded Rhythm Safari, was it to capitalize on the interest in African music? Because I think your initial releases were very African oriented, or world, what they like to call world music orientated.
For the first 3 years, literally, we were a production company. We were producing the Savuka stuff, and I signed a bunch of other artists, and we did some interesting recordings, but I licensed some. But, you know, I had signed a girl called Cecilia Noel, who was this mad Peruvian. And I thought, this is Gloria Estefan on speed. And she's amazing. And her drummer and her boyfriend at the time was Tristan Bowden, that became Chicago's drummer still to this day. She brought in the Tower of Power horns. She was mates with everybody in L.A. We made a couple of, I thought, incredibly compelling tracks. So I started calling the labels and saying, guys, I'm doing a showcase of Cecilia Noel at my place, a place in Santa Monica. And, you know, I got a couple of, you know, Hispanic stuff. Gloria Estefan's a one-off thing. And one guy said to me, I'm not going to be in town that day. And I said, why? He said, because I'm going to Seattle. I said, what are you going to Seattle for? He said, well, you know, this Nirvana thing and this grunge thing's happening. And as an A&R guy, if I don't show my expense account that I went to Seattle, I'll probably get fired. I mean, literally, that was the thought process at the time. So I kind of thought, you know what? I can't do this much more. I've got to form my own label. The obvious first thing was to do world music. So my first releases were, I think, four albums. I did a compilation called The Best of World Music. The Best of Chaluka I released, because Chaluka wasn't signed internationally. Savuka was with Warners, but not Chaluka. I did a Manfred Mann album called Plain Music, where Manfred did an album based on a Native American music. Thought it was a nice match to the South African thing. And I released Dave Hewitt's African Tapestry album I licensed. So those were our first four releases. And in fact, you know, the first 2 years we won at the NAMM convention, at the Retailers Convention, Independent Label of the Year, concentrating predominantly on African and crossover world music. Only a bit later did I dabble with other things.
You did quite a few albums with Carole King.
I did the Color of Your Dreams album with Carole as a partnership. It was the period where CD sales were going mad. And an album that could sell 300,000 or 500,000 was ho-hum to the music industry. They were all wanted to, you know, the A&R guys all wanted to prove that they could sign a flying pig that farts and be hip, cool. And, you know, these old toppies were uncool. So that started me doing, a bunch of older artists. And Carole had just been dropped by Capitol after a City Lights album, and she recorded Color of Your Dreams at her producer's studio, her guitarist, Rudy Guess, and in fact licensed the one song to the Madonna movie A League of Their Own. And that still to this day is like one of the, certainly in the US, a very well-known track that streams all the time. And then we did a live in concert album, which was almost Tapestry plus live in conjunction with the PBS television special. Then I was starting to get calls because all the older artists were looking for deals. None of the majors were signing them. I got a call from BMG in Europe to say, listen, we've signed Foreigner and we've sent it to the American company and they're not interested. do you want to release the Mr. Moonlight album in the US and Canada? So I said, great. And in fact, there was a really interesting experience for me because, you know, you deal with lawyers and you do deals all over the place. And some lawyers are real dickheads, others are reasonable, etc. Some of them have to prove that their bill is worthy, so they have to argue about nonsense. The easiest contract I ever negotiated was with Don Passman, who wrote the book, This Business of Music, as the lawyer for Foreigner. Literally, we sorted everything out in 3 hours around the table.
And it was a good album. I mean, it
did. A great album. We had the number one AC hit, you know, and to their credit, it was a reunion for Mick and Lou at the time. They got on the road with our promotion team and every single morning for 6 weeks visited a different radio station, 7 a.m. and played live. You know, we had a number one AC record and we tried to take it to top 40. And the system of bonusing the promotion people was there. And we decided we're going to quadruple bonus every guy that gets it on a station for us. And we were promised that we were going to go top 10 the first week of our top 40. As the returns started coming in on the Tuesday, the stations that were on our list as guaranteed were falling off. And I phoned our guy that was coordinating the promotion. I said, what the hell's going on? And he said, I've spoken to the guys. And they said, we got a call from the head of one of the major labels saying, we give you money every week to promote our records. We know these guys are paying you much more. But if you do not get the new Elton John single on ahead of that, basically, we're going to cut you. I learned the hard way that you can't fight the majors.
When did you move to Australia?
I was in LA 87 to 97. I was there 10 years. And it was actually the earthquake in 94 that was the beginning. The family was okay. I mean, we had a great time in LA. And it was the right time for me, you know, business-wise to be there. I had done a joint venture for all the pop stuff. After the Carole King first record, Priority, who were distributing my records, approached me and said, we'd like to do a joint venture and sign. We also had an AC hit with Christopher Cross, and we were at the time doing an album with REO Speedwagon. And I was turning down. I don't want to mention the names of some of the artists that came that were making terrible records. And then in the middle of it all, Capitol bought Priority. And at that time, I decided I was going to buy my label back and do my own thing again. And that was when I started thinking moving. And then the 94 earthquake happened, and we had some pretty crazy experiences during that. We were living quite near the epicenter. What am I doing here? Linda, my wife, would never really settle there. And we had originally put our papers in to come to Australia. So we decided there's a juncture in my career. I can, you know, this is a good time to move.
And you've continued with Rhythm Safari in Australia?
For the first few years, I was active. I was signing some acts. I licensed the First Night Records catalog from my mate, John Craig, who's the first guy to have a hit with Jaluka when he had Safari Records. And then he had First Night Records as a partnership with Cameron McIntosh and had all the McIntosh hits. So we had Les Mis and Miss Saigon. And musicals were a big thing here. So it was a great catalog for me to have. And, you know, my philosophy of running a label was always you need a catalog and then the hits can be the cream on top. And, you know, that was the same thing here. For quite a few years now, I felt it's not the industry I fell in love with. I manage my catalog. I do some work. I work on some projects. I'm working on some movies. I did a couple of movies, music supervision and production in the States as well before I left. And so I fortunately am in a position where I can pick and choose to do some projects when I feel like it.
As 1985 dawned, things were looking dire in South Africa. The townships were burning. The economy had tanked. Sanctions were hurting. There wasn't even a Rubicon to cross. And the national mood was one of despair. And into this dark hour came an event that was to bring together South Africans of all color and musical persuasions in a spirit of togetherness. The Concert in the Park on January 12 sent a powerful message to us all and the world of what was possible in this wounded country. So on the back of the double album of the same name, you're credited as, quote, conceived and organized by Hilton Rosenthal. So the obvious question is, how did you and why did you come up with that concept?
I picture it like yesterday. I lived in the northern suburbs, quite near LA, and I went to Dion's in Wynberg on a Saturday morning to look at the record store and to chat to the guys, et cetera, et cetera. And I get in my car driving home and I hear 702 is on, and they're having a telethon to raise money for Operation Hunger. Within those few minutes, Pierre de Chamois calls, and he says, hey, I'm an artist, I believe in this thing, and I challenge all artists in South Africa to give 50 Rand or 100 Rand. I can't remember the number, but, you know, that was basically the trigger. So I'm sitting thinking, what do I do? You know, I'm going to phone up and say, every musical A&R guy, give 1,000 Rand, 500 Rand, 20 Rand, whatever it is, and, you know, we'll raise 1,000 Rand. Wouldn't it be great to do something really special? And, you know, I didn't have a specific idea in mind, but I kind of was thinking maybe a concert. Live Aid hadn't happened yet. This is 6 months before Bob Geldof's concert. You know, I believe a lot in fate. You know, the moment that I had that thought to phone Muriel on a Sunday night, could have been Monday, and it was too late. Those type of moments. On the Monday morning, Izzy Kirsch phones me, the CEO of 702, and he says, you know, we're just opening today our new studios in Maputo-Tswana, up north near Pretoria, and I'm going up for lunch in a helicopter. Do you want to come? So I said, yeah, sure. Interesting. We get in the helicopter. And we drive and we have lunch and look at these wonderful studios and the transmitters. And we get back in and we're flying back over Joburg. And as we're banking in to come into land, we fly over Ellis Park. So I lean over to Izzy. I said, you know, by the way, I was listening to your telethon on Saturday. I thought of the idea of a concert, but how are we going to get a place like this? He says, I know Louis late. I'll call him this afternoon. And he called me back. He said, Louis said you can have the stadium for free as long as you pay for the cleaning. So I went, okay. The beauty of Joburg at that time with the South African industry was we all knew each other. In 3 days, I had spoken to every label, to every manager. You know, the idea was to have half black, half white, and Juluka as the one mixed band in the middle kind of thing. And we had that all sorted out. I spoke to Alan Gein and got the sound system for free. Everyone, there was one vendor that gave me a hard time saying he'd think about it. And when I phoned Coliseum Acoustics and said, look, you book these guys every week. Can you exert some pressure? And Coliseum phoned and said, look, if you want us to use you anymore, you give this stuff for free. It's the only mini negative that I had. And within 3-4 days, we had the layout of concert. And I phoned Percy Tucker at CompuTicket. Percy agreed to give all the ticketing. So, you know, it was not without its problems. My son was born on the 7th of December. The concert was in January. I'm standing in the hospital. My son has just been born. And I get a call from Koloi Labona to say, the black managers are feeling a little left out. You've incorporated the bands, but these guys want to be more involved in the, you know, the structuring and in the organization. I said, with pleasure. God, I'll take any help I can. We had a meeting that afternoon and everything was sorted out and we had a board of guys that, you know, that were happy to help. But other than that, it was one of those things that just nothing went wrong. And boy, could things have gone wrong.
What were you thinking when you decided this? I mean, the thought of organizing an event at Ellis Park within such a tight frame, never mind the eventual turnout, which we'll talk about. It must have been daunting. You must have had sleepless nights.
I remember Denzel Fagelson was working with me, and he was Steve Gakana's manager at the time. Denz helped me, and there were just everybody was pitching in ideas. And you know, the bottom line is, what did we need? We needed the marketing. 702 was going to do the marketing. We needed a sound system. Coliseum Acoustics agreed to do the sound and lights. We needed, security. We got the usual security guys, the staging guys. Everybody basically pitched in. So it was mainly a coordination thing rather than me sitting having to really, I mean, I didn't sleep for 6 weeks, but, you know, it wasn't as daunting as I thought. And we really put together every sound system that the country had at the time. And we'd put barbed wire around the back of the stage and we thought, we'll have 35,000 people. So that was what the plan was.
I've heard all kinds of numbers on attendance. So what's the real numbers?
So I'm calling Percy every day the week before to see what CompuTicket has sold, right? And on Monday, he tells me we've sold 5,000. Concert's on Saturday. Tuesday, it's 10,000. Wednesday, it's 15,000, 17,000. And it's growing. By Friday afternoon, it was 35,000. Needless to say, the official number of tickets sold ended up being 100,000. But there are a lot of people got in without paying, not because they were trying to be nasty or illegal, but literally there was such a crush. At about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call on the walkie-talkie on the security, and it says, gate number such and such is coming off its hinges. And I run out and I see this throng of people, and the gate is just coming up and falling. And I'm thinking, God, is somebody going to get killed here? Not an injury, not an anything, but you know, the unofficial number is somewhere around 120 to 125,000. Backstage, we had this huge area wired off. After the concert, the barbed wire was flat. It was paper. There were just people standing everywhere that you could find. And how people heard anything, because sound systems weren't, you know, really not built for that.
I mean, it was on the scale of Live Aid. I don't like to say the equivalent of Live Aid, because I think it was very different to Live Aid. It was not only the biggest live event, which I think it probably still holds the record for the biggest concert here.
I guess so.
But it also gathered together the biggest artists on one stage. I mean, when I think about that, the artistic ego battles and the label pressures must have been huge. There must have been some noses out of joint from artists who didn't get on the bill. I know some of my artists were phoning me and saying, but you're involved in this. You can get us on there. Were there all those ego battles? I mean, or did the artists really come to the party?
Listen, by and large, the artists came to the party. There were times where I just had to be a dickhead. Listen, why are we on in the afternoon and we want to be on when the lights are? Listen, because that's where your space is and I can't do anything about it. I'm not changing the lineup. You know, if you look at the size of the artists, it was programmed. You know, the guys that had a smaller following played at the beginning and at the end, and it built up during the afternoon and the evening. You know, when Jaluka came on the stage at about 7:30, it was like, you were there, right? I mean, it was just, I was standing next to Louis Late and the place was going mad. And in fact, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I would think it was 50% white, 50% black in terms of audience as well. Louis looked at me and he said, I don't know what you've done here. He just shook his head. He said, I can't believe what's going on. I phoned Percy on the Monday morning to say thank you. And he said to me, thank me. I did not sell a ticket for any other event on Saturday morning. I didn't make a penny on Saturday because nobody could get in other than to your concert.
Jaluka was amazing. Who else do you think raised the bar that day?
Evoid was phenomenal. There were so many great performances. It's really hard to kind of start singling people out.
When you look back now, what is it? We're going to be coming up for, what, 40 years soon? What do you remember the most about it, Hilton?
Well, I remember maybe 5 o'clock, the head of police coming to me and saying, you know, we cannot believe what's happened here. We normally have a crowd of 20,000 at a rugby match and arrest 1,000 people. Here we've got this 100-something thousand and we've had 32 arrests. None of them violent, just people that we've had to remove from the place. So that, you know, for me was very, very heartwarming. I was on a high, obviously, and I walked into the production office at about 6 in the evening, and there a journalist from the Soweto newspaper, and I said to him, hey, man, isn't this unbelievable? And he said to me, I think it's awful. You're breeding fat slaves. I wish you weren't feeding these people, and the revolution came sooner. If there was one moment that cemented my decision to leave South Africa, that was probably it. I started feeling helpless for a while. It's a negative, and that it's not something that should be pervading the main emotions of an incredible day. For me, the response to Jaluka was just unbelievable.
Concert in the Park is kind of like Woodstock in a way, in that everybody I meet says, well, I was there. If I had to tally up all the people who said they were at Concert at the Park, it's like Woodstock. You know, people say, well, it was a million people. And there weren't a million people. When you look back,
yes.
I remember being proud that day.
Absolutely.
When I look back, do you think that Concert at the Park contributed socially and politically to the changes that were going to come 4 years later?
It's hard for me to say, but I have read commentary that has said that that was the day that gave South African, you know, and in particular the young people of South Africa, an idea of what the country could become. For that, I'm extremely proud and grateful.
Hilton Rosenthal, thank you so much for spending time with us on From the Hub. It's been an absolute pleasure. We could talk for hours about all the people we know and what's happened to so-and-so, and do you remember this? Because we both go back a long time. I'm just glad that we're both here.
So am I, Benjamin. Thank you so much. Likewise, you know, you've done so much through the years, you know, apart from your help with Concert in the Park, I remember your help with Graceland and so many other things. And more recently, you know, your ideas of revitalizing a lot of the old South African stuff. You're one of my heroes, mate. Thank you.
Thank you, Hilton. Likewise.
Cheers.
The Jaluka and Savuka songs used in this episode are courtesy of Mink Records and Mink Music.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.
Zokulula wena.